Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, we've been following Ian Dumbrell. He's been living in his car for nearly a year and a half now. I've had him in several times on this show, but now he's finally got a flat this week in Cadbury Heath. Also, the Trump special, Sonia Maughan and Susan Lindauer's views from both sides of the Atlantic on the man who looks set to be the new US president. Also, the naval school in Portishead, Andy Richard talks about that. And she put all of her savings into a sustainable future in Norfolk and lost it all, and her children, Linda Beamish. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. That's 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also through Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk or the national do-it.org. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show.
It took a long time to come. I was virtually on the edge of giving up, to be honest.
This is all right, isn't it?
I'm Ian, and I now have a flat in Cadbury Heath in Bristol after spending 15 months living in my car in Patchway. The property I was living in was sold due to the terms and conditions of my late mum's will. The money was split three ways, and due to landlords, housing association, letting agencies, I was unable to find the property for 15 months.
So what was the problem? I mean, there must be, I mean, you've got some savings, you've got some money from the sale of your mum's home. Surely you can just go and, just like that, literally grab yourself a private rented place.
Nope, because as soon as you mention the words unemployed, but I'm using cash, they think, well, what's he going to do when his savings run out? So that was part of the problem. And also letting agents, as soon as they find out anyone's unemployed, they just really don't want to know.
Now, you initially were talking to Tim Kent at Bristol City Council, but then your previous last place you were living was actually in South Gloucestershire. So how long did it take South Gloucestershire to get you this place?
15 months. I was told it takes a minimum of 2 years being on the Home Choice waiting list to get a property. So that was the problem, basically. I had to wait my turn on the waiting list to get a property.
Now, the thing is also, Ian, is you are arguably disabled, aren't you? Because you've got a problem with your leg.
Thanks to the wonderful medical staff at my surgery in Bradley Stoke, who have treated my leg three times now in the last 9 months. They sent the council a letter telling them that living in my car, my leg's going to get worse. Eventually, living in a car, I could lose the leg because it's already got poisonous once this year. If it happened again, then I could, in theory, lose the leg.
What's up with your leg, if you don't mind me asking?
I've got a burst blood vessel, and what it is I've got a large area of dead skin, and if the skin cracks, it bleeds water, not blood. Yeah, it's not a very nice sight. When the Bradley Stokes surgery discovered that it cracked last November, it took them 8 weeks to get my leg to heal properly. It still requires daily doses of E45 cream, so I have to spend about 20 minutes a day putting E45 cream on the front and the back of my leg to make sure that the skin don't crack, but it will. It's with me for the rest of my life.
So how on earth did you cope in living in your car with that sort of handicap, effectively?
To quote the lines from one of my favourite films, you adapt, you improvise, you overcome. You make do with a bad situation. You know, to raise the leg, you have to open the boot of the car, put your leg up, pull your trouser leg up, put the cream on, pull the trouser leg down. You know, it's a typical, if you've ever worked in the military, you get used to doing things in a certain way. So that sort of, you know, basic military training sort of came into play when it needed to, basically. But you just literally survive from day to day. You get up, you go and have a wash in Asda or services or wherever you can, and then you just make the day what you can do.
But most people wouldn't really want to do that in public. Effectively, that's what you have to do when you're in your car.
Oh yeah, you know, putting the cream on my leg twice a day, you know, you have to do it like in as the car park, where you hide yourself out away so people can't see what you're doing. And then you go in, you have a wash down, you know, you do what you can, and then you just spend the rest of the day trying to fulfill the time to, you know, keep yourself active, keep your mind active so you don't vegetate. But yeah, it was a hard struggle.
What about, do you mention the military? Have you had any military training?
Yeah, I was in the Grenadier Guards for 12 weeks before I was invalided out due to a knee injury.
Okay, and how did that help, do you think?
Spending nights in doing what seemed to be pointless things. You know, you learn to sleep rough, you learn to make the best out of bad conditions, to be honest. But, you know, I survived. I'm grateful for what friends I had supporting me. You know, I made some good friends while being homeless, and I do thank them for everything they've done to help me. You know, there's nothing more I can say about the people I've met. You know, I met one person who's totally ripped me off. You know, if I could, I made a mistake with his friend, who's just turned his back on me. He won't pay the money he owes me, you know. So, you know, I've met some good friends. I've also met one bloke who's a total and utter dirtbag, you know, who he also pretends that he's homeless with medical conditions, but none of us who know him, we don't think he's homeless. We think he's preying on, he's trying to live his life through me.
So have you reported him to the police and that sort of thing? Do you think, because that's important that other homeless people are aware of someone like that?
Oh, yeah. I told the police about him, but he's got enough trouble. You know, the police said, well, we've got enough problems with this bloke, so, you know, we'll just add him to the list of things that we're after him for. But, yeah, I've got a lot of friends who work in the legal profession where he claims to have worked, and nobody knows him, yet he's going around telling all and sundry that I'm a solicitor, but he's not. You know, he never has been a solicitor, he never will be a solicitor, so, you know, he's made a rod for his own back. He tells anybody and everybody that he's going to Mauritius, when he's not. You know, I've known him 15 months, and every day he's going to Mauritius. Well, he's never gone, and I don't think he ever will be going, so... Sorry, Tim, I don't believe you anymore.
Okay, yeah, just give us a bit of a description of him and his name so that other people could be forewarned.
Tim Gupta is his name. He's about 6'2", of Indian origin, who claims his uncle's the high-ranking Ministry of Defence in India. He claims he's got high-ranking officials in Indian government circles. He's just an out-and-out liar, to be honest. If you ever meet him, just stay away from him, because he's not a nice person.
How did you come across him?
I met him in the library. He seemed a nice bloke, you know. He said he'd rent me a flat, which never happened, and then he said he'd do other things that never happened. So after about 6 weeks of meeting him, I just thought, what an utter idiot, you know, why don't you go away? And
were you out of pocket at the end of it all?
Yeah, I'm out of pocket for about 20 quid. You know, he owes me a lot more than 20 quid, but that's how much I'm out of pocket, you know.
But I mean, okay, let's focus on the positive, because you also met some really good people too.
Oh yeah, I met several people who turned out to be good friends. We go out for a meal twice a week. And some of my older friends from that I've known for 30 years, they've supported me for all this. So, yeah, you know, I've met three good friends, Dave, Tim and Rob. And we've become really good friends, you know. I can't thank them enough for all the support that they've gave me over the last 15 months.
Do you think you could have done it on your own, even with a bit of your military training?
No. You need people close to you that you can trust, you can rely on when things get tough. You know, my friend in Birmingham, I've known him for the best part of 30-odd years. You know, we've been on holiday together. You know, I trust him with my life. He trusts me with his. You know, if ever I've got a problem, I just phone him up, tell him what's gone wrong, and he'll help me sort myself out if he can.
Now, you've just moved into this the weekend, or Friday, and it's pretty bare. You can hear it's very echoey because there's not a lot of soft furnishings, curtains, things like that. You've got some nets up, and you've got some boxes with your stuff in here. It's a one-bedroom flat with a reasonable size, what is it, I suppose, 12 by 12 living room. Feet, that is, a kitchen and a bathroom. What was the journey through being, because I know you were offered a couple of places which weren't suitable by the council before you got this one.
Yeah, they sent me to a one-bedroom flat in Patchway where I just couldn't get in the bathroom. The bathroom was so small, I couldn't use the shower. They sort of messed it up. Then they sent me to a brand new housing estate in Thornbury, which was unsuitable because I couldn't really climb the stairs. You know, if you compare this place at Cadbury Heath to the one in Thornbury, the place at Cadbury Heath is twice the size of a new build at Thornbury. And this is better for me because there's no, as you can see on the walls, the plugs are not on the floor level. They're all high-level plugs. It's got a good security system, so you can only get in if I let you in. It's a far better property than the one at Thornbury. But, you know, the Housing Association had really messed me about with that. So, you know, because the paperwork wasn't in place the day of the meeting, then they wouldn't let me have it. But I told them, I'm going to get you the paperwork, be ready at 10 o'clock tomorrow, which it was. They phoned me at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and said, look, the property's gone, you know. So to me, I just wasted a Friday morning running around Bristol, getting the bank statements, getting the pieces of paper that they needed for them only to turn around and say, well, the property's gone, tough.
But you're on the ground floor as well, which is, I suppose, perfect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great floor because, you know, I've got a car parking space, you know, I don't have to run up and down stairs, which damages my legs. So, yeah, you know, it's a good flat. It's ideal for my circumstances, to be honest.
So has it been worth the wait and all the hassle?
I got up, I must admit, Friday, Saturday morning was a bit emotional because I was able to sleep in a bed, get up, have a shower, make myself a cup of coffee, some toast. I know to a lot of people out there that it's just, to them, it seems pointless. But after 15 months of living in a car, living rough, to be able to sleep in a proper bed Friday night, get up Saturday morning, have a shower, have a cup of coffee and some toast, it's the best feeling in the world.
What was your, because I mean I had to spend a whole winter, luckily not two, in the car. What was your worst moment, do you think, during the car, living in it?
Coming back from my holiday in January to a nice, cold, frosty evening, the first night I come back after my holiday and it was ice cold, that was the worst part of it, coming back to this country in January.
And what about the best moment?
December the 5th, flying from Heathrow to Hanoi on a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. It was all worth it. And that was, you know, I know it's a silly statement, but that was the best bit of just leaving the country for 5 weeks, thinking, oh, I've got sun, I've got a bed, you know. I was lucky, I saw my brother, I saw a lot of nice things in Japan, I met some good friends of mine in Thailand, and we had a great great time in Thailand. So yeah, you know, December the 5th when I flew out in off on my holiday.
Were there any good moments when you were living in the car? Did you, I mean, it might sound a silly question, but did you ever actually think, well, actually, this isn't so bad after all at all?
Yeah, most of last year, to be honest. I was able to pursue my photography hobby of chasing from here to Suffolk on various occasions. I was able to see the deployment of F-22 Raptors. I was also able to meet a Marine Corps pilot who arrived on a Saturday, was due to leave on a Sunday, but unfortunately, due to bad weather and operational reasons, he didn't take off until the Thursday. But unfortunately, there was a malfunction on his aeroplane and it blew up, and unfortunately, the pilot was killed. So that was one of the saddest events. But yeah, I've had some good day trips to Suffolk for deployments. You know, I've been to Milton Hall 3 times this year to see various deployments come through the air bases. But yeah, it's been some good points, but a lot of low points as well. But I was out yesterday and this man was begging outside Sainsbury's. You know, I didn't have much money, but I've been where he is. I gave him a couple of quid. He seemed grateful for it. And it's just unfortunately, as I said to you earlier, there's a bloke called Tim Gupta who's going around making himself or giving the impression that he's homeless, but we don't think he is. You know, it's the same for all the homeless people that are living rough. There's this one person going around Bristol saying, I'm homeless, but we don't think he is. So, you know, to all the people that are homeless, keep the faith. You will get something eventually.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined by Sonia Moore now. Sonia, you're an occasional contributor to the show. You've been hanging around the studio a few weeks, and you have a lot to say about Donald Trump. You think he'll make a good US president?
I definitely think. Well, where do I start? I mean, if you want to look at Trump, I would support Trump if I was an American voting, because he is staunch Republican and his values are essentially Republican in the traditional sense.
Like George W. Bush. Because he started, how many wars did he start?
Well, George Bush, in my opinion, was not true to form Republican. And in fact, the whole Republican movement, as it stands today, is not really representative of the traditional values of the Republican Party. And what we've seen since the rise of Trump is the backlash against the elite members of the Republican Party who've actually been against Trump. But if you look at Trump's policies, and whether you like Trump because he's got funny hairdo or whatever, is that it's more about what he stands for, and essentially he's going to be good for America. He's going to be good because he is going to support the borders, which no one else ever talked about. He brought that up, but then became trendy to start talking about borders. So I have to congratulate him on that for bringing up something that no one else dared to talk about. And actually, the borders question was actually something that was brought up many years ago, but then was dropped. So it was always actually in the pipeline people were talking about borders
States,
and border control.
They've always had this thing with Mexico, haven't they, where there's just all the checkpoints, but there's a tacit agreement that it's good for America to have all the cheap labor coming over from Mexico. So it's been there, but it's an official thing. They don't want the Mexicans to come in, but unofficially they love them.
Well, the Mexican labor force is something that Trump is not going to deny. I mean, he's saying come into America, but come in legally. So the issue over border control is about the illegals coming in. And of course, there's a natural issue with that, as it is with any country. Trump's stance is if you don't have a country unless you have borders. So all he's saying is you can come to this country, but bring your papers and make sure you come in legally. There will be opportunities for you here if you come in legally.
Every single president and every prime minister in this country makes all sorts of promises, don't they, before they become elected. What makes you think that there's anything different about Trump?
Well, I think the way I look at it is that Trump has made this stance. He's made this stance his own. He's created this topic. And I do believe this is something that
Hang on, there's much more to running America than about the border.
Than just
Mexico.
One border. Yeah, this is something, one topic I picked on. So, because it's obviously, there's a few issues around that. And there are obviously a lot of misguided information out there about what's perceived over the topics over border. But essentially, Trump is saying you've got to come in legally.
He's not made a very good example of himself in Scotland, has he, with his golf course, and also really annoying some of the local residents creating this golf course, really ramming through planning permission, being rude to old Scottish ladies, this kind of thing has not made him a great favourite. In fact, he's also been talking about, and you maybe can update us on this, he's been saying that he's not going to allow any Muslims to come into the United States. In fact, he was even talking about possibly deporting Muslims. This sounds a bit like he's going down this kind of real racist route.
Well, this is the whole, you know, you get a lot of that media against Trump. They're all out, you know, this is where the issue about media and Trump comes up, which is another separate debate, which is Trump.
Well, he went so far as to say, oh, well, actually, the mayor of London's a Muslim. He can come to America. You know, so he's making an issue of it himself. He's saying, making an exception for the mayor of London, saying, oh, he can come to America, but the rest of the Muslims can't.
I think that's probably where maybe your misunderstanding of what Trump has actually said, and I followed him quite closely over this, because obviously I would have concerns if he was making racist statements. And essentially what he's saying is quite simple, is that you, as a Muslim, maybe you are a Muslim or of any, but particularly Muslims, because at this moment in time, there is an issue linked with being, you know, ISIS members coming from certain parts of the country like Syria. He's saying we need to tighten up on that. We don't know who you are. We accept you're a Muslim, but we don't know who you are. So what we're saying, we need to see your paperwork. So if you don't have any paperwork, he said, we can't let you in. And I think that's fair. If you've got a country, you have to have some measures and control to operate a system whereby you can have law and order.
So do you think there's a similar thing going on with Dover? And, you know, because we were talking about the Mexican border in San Isidro, I think it is, isn't it, in Southern California. Have we got a similar thing going on in Dover? Because you have kind of, because there's a parallel, isn't there, to draw here between the Democratic Party in the States and Labour here as against the Conservative Party here and the Republicans.
That's interesting, because people have been trying to draw comparisons between the political regimes, well, what's going over in America as what's happening here.
Borders and immigration has become a big issue.
Borders
are
a big issue,
too.
But the way that the Americans, I mean, the border control issue over in America is actually pretty dire at the moment. I mean, this is something that the border control itself has been crying out for to the American presidents and saying we need more help and financial support. In fact, Barack Obama has actually made strident steps to actually cut funding for border control, which is pretty shocking.
You know,
given
it's not so shocking. It's the same exact thing that's been going on in Britain with the border agency under Theresa May.
Right. Well, there you go. So I would suggest that's probably a very interesting point, maybe if you could draw the comparison between the two. But equally, that's not acceptable. It's not acceptable for a country to operate on that basis if it chooses or wants its sovereignty and what wishes to remain a country.
There's also the massive nuclear arsenal the Americans have got. I can remember hearing some recordings from the end of the Second World War with President Truman saying, thank God the atomic bomb came to us and not to the other side. Well, the Americans have got all these nukes kind of probably more than anyone else on the planet. It may be the Russians have got something like the same number. But do you think, you know, the world's safe with someone like Trump? He does seem very capricious and seems to change his mind quite a lot.
No, I think my opinion of Trump is fairly consistent. I mean, if you go back and watch interviews pre-Trump today, you will see back in the early 80s, before he considered presidency, and how his interest was within politics has always remained the same in terms of his policies and his understanding. He's always felt that the country was being ripped off, but he chose not to take any political candidacy since then, because he's a businessman and that was his preference at the time. I think the move where he's decided to make move into politics is because he feels that no one else is suitable to do the job. He's backed so many other people. He's felt he's had enough. Every time he backs someone like Romney, he just does a U-turn. And, you know, so he's felt time now is now, it's now or never. And he felt Obama's taking the American country.
So he suppose he's thinking, if you can't do it properly, do it yourself.
DIY.
And what about Hillary Clinton? What do you make of her? Is the probably going to be the main person running against him?
Well, where do you start with Hillary Clinton? I mean, I think with all the scandals over the Clintons just generally, I think if anyone wants to look up Hillary Clinton's scandals, I think it's well understood she is actually a liar and has lied on many occasions, or as what they are now coining the term, misled people. It's understood that she's incapable of answering a question directly or has actually given misleading information over, especially in the case of the email scandal.
Yeah, these are all these leaked emails, actually. I think probably, I'm not really sure about all this, but it looks to me as if the Russians managed to filch these emails and then leaked them out through WikiLeaks. Am I right?
This is a big thing. We are waiting for these emails to surface so far. I mean, if we're talking about WikiLeaks.
Quite a few of them have come out, haven't they? I mean, some of them I've read, one or two. I mean, these are ones to do with Benghazi, an incident in Benghazi where the American ambassador was killed. Apparently, there was Hillary Clinton and the State Department was involved in all that, you know, and she knew that there were risks, but she was prepared to take them. And it ended up with the ambassador being killed, the Libyan ambassador, American ambassador to Libya being killed.
That might well be so, because, I mean, there's talk at the moment that more emails are yet to surface with regards to Hillary Clinton.
Maybe they're saving the best ones right till the weeks end. Before the yeah, end of the end. Election.
Which could be quite poignant, really, because at the moment...
She was using her own personal, I think it was an AOL account or something at home for all this top secret stuff.
Not just that, she actually told people that she was only using one device, and it was only for the use of one device. But actually, it was found that she was using about four or five devices. And then, of course, she told the American people that she was only using her private server so she could contact her family and friends. And that when she, conveniently deleted 33,000 emails, which, to be honest, even between friends and family is quite a lot, she actually did it because she felt that was they were private emails between her and her husband. Actually, an interview between Bill Clinton and another journalist conveyed that actually Bill Clinton only ever sent Hillary Clinton two emails from what he understood. So
I've got news for Hillary, by the way. You pressing delete is not going to delete your emails. Someone else has still got copies of
them. I think it'd be quite good if someone could get those emails and put them and publish them, because then we can see the fraud that she actually is and the fraud that she perpetuates.
Let me also remind listeners about her and her husband's involvement in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas, of the drug running through MENA Air Base. I mean, that's basically how the Clinton family rose to success, is because they were involved in drug running, and the powers that be in the United States, the FBI and the CIA, said, oh, well, these guys can be trusted. We've got dirt on them. We know that they'll do as they're told.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, the whole basis for the Clinton Foundation, which is a so-called charity which she runs, has been caught up with a number of illegal, basically money being laundered through her so-called charity. And it's caught up with a number of issues, all of which people can look up online and find authors have written books on this. Roger Stone is one key author who's written a lot about the Clintons, especially the Clintons' War on Women, where he actually accuses Hillary Clinton of being a direct accessory of, putting women down for actually coming forward against Bill Clinton and his, because Bill Clinton was basically named and shamed over a number, not just Monica Lewinsky, but a number of women came forward, and it's all written out in the book.
Well, we often forget, don't we, that there was an attempt to impeach Bill Clinton because of his having sexual relations in the White House with all sorts of floozies.
Yes, and we never forget that famous phrase from Bill Clinton. It's, I smoked, but I didn't inhale. When he was under investigation. I mean, it's just, you can't make this stuff up.
No, is Trump going to win, though?
I would like to think that Trump would win because at the moment where he stands on his policies, he's very strong, and it just he's the right person right now for America, because America's right in a right state economically. We know that the American dollar is literally worthless at this present moment.
Well, hang on, because William Engdahl, he's a Russian-German commentator, not used by the BBC at all, but he's extremely good, and he's pointed out that Trump's actually risen back to being solvent. He's gone bankrupt several times, and the way he's done that is through his mafia connections.
Well, the allegations of a mafia connection is very interesting, because I think it would be very difficult for anybody, given the fact that he has had such prominence within certain areas in America and even Manhattan. It's well known fact that the CIA and the mafia, it's alleged, that operate hand in hand, and that anyone.
Well, I'd agree with
anyone,
that, yeah.
Anyone who's a business owner in their own right operates at the capacity that Donald Trump would operate at would have to brush shoulders with the mafia, and it's a given. Otherwise, you don't operate as a business, full stop. You cannot gain contracts over suppliers, and in particular, the allegations over concrete suppliers within his building companies. Yeah. I mean, I accept that, but that doesn't, to me, tarnish Mr. Trump to the extent that he's incapable of running and correcting the processes.
But look, this is supposed to be a democracy. For a lot of people will say, well, actually, we would rather neither of these two people were standing, because neither of them can really be trusted to run one of the most powerful militaries that the earth has ever seen, and an incredibly powerful country, a massive economy.
Well, your understanding of Hillary Clinton, we obviously both agree that she's about as rotten as you can get, and she will lie. And it's been a given fact that Obama actually made this statement in his running election against Hillary. He said quite openly that Hillary will say anything and do nothing, was what he quoted. The fact that he now endorses her and he's anti-Trump suggests to me, and obviously you have to look at the way she operated as Secretary of State within the US under Benghazi. I mean, it's just, I mean, where do you start and where do you stop with Hillary Clinton? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't trust as far as I could throw her, but she's so wrong for the American people. She doesn't have the policies Trump has. Trump's originated these policies. These policies come from where he sees as clear thinking, clear, straightforward thinking, and I genuinely believe that he is there to back the American people. Maybe he's doing a U-turn. He's actually come out openly to people, and he's always said, I've always been part of the establishment. Now, what, you want to use that word, establishment? I think people know that there are definite connections between, you know, the media, the mafia sources and the CIA. I mean, that's kind of a given. But
interesting, you got the media and the mafia mixed up.
Sorry,
there.
That was right. Freudian slip. Yes,
anyway,
very interesting.
Look, Sonia Mourne, really interesting to get your views, and let's keep discussing this as we get closer, because I'm sure there'll be more revelations from the US.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really looking out for these emails. I can't wait.
So we go from Sonia Mourne on Trump, 3,000 miles west across the Atlantic, to CIA whistleblower Susan Lindauer, the author of Extreme Prejudice. What does she make of Donald Trump?
Hillary Clinton is on record saying that if she is elected president, there will be war with Iran. She's on record saying it. And she's on record saying that she hopes there will be a false flag operation, just using those words. She hopes there will be a false flag terrorist attack. Let's get it over with so we can get on with this war. She is very, very dangerous. She's not hiding anything. She may be, they may try to soft play, pedal it now and downplay it right now, but she is out there on the record saying that they want to have a U.S. intervention
so
in Syria.
So she's saying effectively that the Western powers, NATO, should attack itself and then blame it on Iran.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes, she is. Yes, she is. But Donald Trump is, now here's the other side of it. Trump is more definitely a man of the people at this stage. He is representing a force of people who are Republican and conservative or centrist, but who deeply oppose these the waste that we're terrified. Anybody with a brain is now terrified of the debt that this that has piled up from these wars, $4.5 trillion for Iraq, $1.5 to $2 trillion for Afghanistan, and that was figures from 2 years ago. Okay, so in the past 2 years, there's been even more debt acquired for these wars. It's about $6.5 trillion of our $19 trillion debt, and at the point of $24 trillion, that's the breakdown where a country reaches the point of no return. So we're at the point where the United States isn't going to make it. And when it goes down, we're not going to ever get up again. We will be the failed state. And we will not, the government will not be capable of providing anything for the people at all. It's all going to, it's at a breaking point. We're at a breaking point for the country. And so a lot of people support Donald Trump for that reason. And Trump is not going to back down on that point. That's one thing I do believe. I truly believe that if Trump is elected, there will not be any more wars. He will not tolerate terrorism in the United States, but he will not go to war overseas.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined by Andy Richards. Andy, are you actually a Bristolian? Were you born in Bristol?
I was born in Bristol Maternity Hospital, yes, but I lived in Portishead for a good part of my life up to about the age of 12. So I went to Gordano School, wonderful place.
And also, were you around at Portishead when that, is it like a naval college place was actually open?
Oh, yes, the nautical school. Yes,
the nautical school for nautical boys, nautical boys.
Naughty nautical boys, which originally started in Bristol under the Merchant Ventures. And it went to Portishead in 1906.
Wow.
No, it might have been a bit before that. And it went originally to the ship, which was moored off the pier. Lots of pictures of it on the internet. And it moved from there up to Redcliffe Bay to the school, at the nautical school on Nore Road.
I mean, if people haven't seen it, it's an incredible building, isn't it?
It was an incredible building when it was a nautical school.
So you went in there, did you?
Oh, from the age of five. And I also went into Nore House, which was an orphanage for lots of children to do with Barnardos. And it was like a country house sort of thing, and there were lots of children there. My mother used to go and take them to the beach, and I used to go along.
Okay, so give us a bit of an insight before we get stuck into a bit more about you. Mm-hmm. What was the nautical school actually like inside when it was – because as I understand it, young people, some used to be sent there for all different sorts of reasons from across the country. It was a little bit like an approved school or something. If you'd been naughty, you might get sent there.
It was an approved school. That would be a very good way of putting it, run on a naval basis – by naval or ex-naval captains and ratings, and you did everything like that. They had a mess where the food was prepared, and somebody would be in charge of that every Sunday morning, and they were responsible for the activity of the people on their table. And there was quite harsh jankers if you didn't do what you were supposed to do.
I even heard that at one point that there were hammocks in the dormitories, almost mm-hmm. like being on a ship.
It was. You were intended to learn to be a seaman, and as a result of that, I would say that 95% of the outtake went into the Merchant Navy or the Royal Navy.
Yeah, most went to the Merchant Navy, didn't they?
I think they did, because there were a lot of ships recruiting out of Avonmouth and Bristol. Many ended up on the Bristol Channel lines.
Yeah, sad to see. I mean, it's quite easy to go. Basically, it's just if you go down to Portishead and walk about a mile and a half, something like that, down the coast south, there it is on your left, a great big building. It's all being privatised now. It looks like luxury flats, luxury houses. Someone's made a fortune out of it. But it's from another age, isn't it?
It's from the 1900s. Whilst there were some people who would have found it difficult to acclimatise, it was really lots of children who had no background, no home life, who ended up as urchins, really, and were put there, and it really made them. A bit like new in national service. But
a lot of people now today would say this is terrible, you shouldn't be doing that.
Doubtless. Oh, it was not politically correct. We couldn't do that.
But do you think it actually was good for some of these youngsters?
They learned to do a trade. They learned to understand the need to look after themselves and other people. And in my experience, they were very well turned out. It was, they used to come down on the train when the trains ran before 1964. And they used to go and row in the docks in their whaler. And they used to row off of Nore Point as well. There was a slipway off the beach, and there was an open swimming pool in their grounds, which was not heated. And they used to have a gala in there. I think the biggest thing I always remembered was on Remembrance Day, Remembrance Sunday, the church was done out. It was open to everybody, and you went in and all, they were all
there.
That's
on the main road, isn't it? That
yes,
runs along the top
in their number
there,
ones.
Yeah.
Right. And the officers were all there. And lots of ex-military officers that weren't part of that. They were naval. You could go in. And then afterwards, they opened the nautical school up, and you could go and have a conducted tour. One of the lads would take you around and show you their berths. And really quite educational. And I think these are the things that I've been lucky in my life. I've had education, not just from my mother, my father, but people around me have taken me to places. And there's a lot of things looking back that I might like to have done, but I was fortunate enough to do lots of things, be taken to lots of places. And I've conducted that with my children's education, and they are now really respectable people in the community, doing good jobs, quite well educated, not from an amazing university education, but they're doing interesting things, and they're not frightened to get involved in something, to go and look and say, no, that doesn't look right, or I could do something about it.
We were talking in the previous interview actually about critical thinking, whether you can teach that at school. Probably not so easy, but it's not happening so much nowadays.
Critical thinking is part of two things. You have to have the rudimentary material in the beginning. So you have to have a child which is receptive and able to take in. And I'm not singling anybody out. That is one of those things that some people have got it and some haven't. But then you've got to encourage them to pick up the tools and to cut the piece of wood with a sword, a knife, without hurting themselves, to understand that might be hot and not to touch it. And I think these are the things that are paramount. And you, what you do is you take all these things away in a school, you take all the machines away and all the bits of equipment they could use, and you give them a pencil, and all they will ever be able to do is draw. Because by the time they got to school leaving age, they'd be too frightened to do anything else.
I can remember actually studying physics and looking at some of the contraptions they gave us and thinking, crikey, should they let us kids anywhere near that thing?
Well, they're thinking of Van de Graaff generators.
Well, things with radioactive signs all over it, et cetera.
Well, you've got uranium nitrate, then, aren't you?
Anyway,
as long as you don't get close to it.
I mean, after being brought up in Portishead, you ended up helping to manufacture, make heating things, boilers.
Well, I got involved.
Engineering.
At the age of 10 or 12, I knew what I wanted to do in life, and I wanted to be an engineer. And my first thoughts were to have a lorry with all the machinery on it and go around farms repairing things, a bit like the Remy, that sort of thing.
What's that?
The Remy, Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers, what the Army have, you know, bridge builders and pioneering the way, making things, repairing things, recovering vehicles and whatever. My boss, who was in the RAF, had been in the RAF National Service, and he'd been involved in radar. He'd been down at RAF Locking, and he said, it would have either straightened you out or killed you, one or the other. So, no, I don't think I missed out on not being in the military.
But there's not much manufacturing going on in Bristol anymore, is there? I mean, you must have seen quite a lot of changes.
I've seen the demise. I started engineering in 1973 down by St. Philip's, by the fruit market. In a company called Rotodex. And I went to South Bristol College, and I did a year off the job where I got very good marks. I got, I think, two ones. And then I did an improvement course, and I went to Brunel Tech and did a National Certificate in Engineering, which was excellent.
But why? It was just the question, isn't it? Why are we now in a situation where we've got so little manufacturing?
Because the political part of the UK decided a long time ago that we weren't going to be a manufacturer. And the biggest change in that was under Margaret Thatcher, where she decided, because of reasons better known to them, that they would destroy the miners. And in doing so, they destroyed engineering education at the same time. quite what they had in mind, I'm not sure, but they destroyed something called the EITB, the Engineering Industrial Training Board. And that was the organization which oversaw the training of mainly young men into professions. And they decided that what they would do is they'd focus on university and they'd teach them all the academic side of it and they wouldn't do any of the practical side. And my father said to me, son, well, you can go into engineering. He said, but you'll never get rich. He said, if you want to be rich, be an accountant or a solicitor. He said, but you'll find engineering challenging and interesting and you'll never get paid much. But by the time you come to leave it, engineers will be in such short supply that the price will have gone up. And he was right. But then my father was right about quite a lot of things.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Linda Beamish. I'm an architectural designer and I specialise as a social entrepreneur, as an arc designer. The vision for the future being sustainable communities that are autonomous, such as eco-villages, basically where people can live in their own communities without needing to claim any form of benefits whatsoever. So without any reliance on the welfare state as it is today. Crumbling, basically. The overall aim of the launch of the ARC, intended in 2012, was to help to save the UK government and government departments funding, because we knew that recession was coming from lectures given in 2002, and we knew that there would be an economical crisis, the scale that there is, and in fact the second wave's due soon. So what we needed was an alternative system to the welfare state that we knew would be crumbled by this. And that's what essentially all the work went into. And that was it, really. The more people that we could help to live in eco-villages, then the more money that we saved the government, government departments and the taxpayers at the end of the day. Because not everybody wants to claim any form of benefits. And it doesn't support us all, and we have evidence to prove that, really. We were then prevented from launching the ARC because the vehicle purchase specifically to use, the local authorities have basically stonewalled. They have provided forms to fill in. They haven't looked at the evidence. I have gone all the way through all the departments that I can think of, banged my head on every single one of them. Green Party councillor Adrian Dinley very kindly helped me to fill in the accounts form. I gave him access to all my bank statements and on my online bank account, because that served also for the social enterprises, because the bankers wouldn't give any accounts, so we couldn't apply for grant funding. And he's put all of that together, but still North Norfolk District Council are expecting me to be able to manage with more going out than I've got coming in. North Norfolk District Council in particular, Norfolk County Council. Also in 2014, HMRC stopped child tax credit. So on a salary effectively, having paid the money out, which was circa £40,000, I only earned £700 in 20 months afterwards. And then the following year, HMRC stopped child tax credits because we couldn't do what we were going to with my daughter's home study plan. Everything fell through. We were left to freeze to death on a field. We had no heat, no access to bath or laundry facilities for 6 months. And at the same time, Lord Freud was saying that everybody... all self-employed, single parents and sickness claimants live in comfort on a few hundred quid annual wages without taking risks. My middle son had to go and live with his father rather than, he didn't want to stay on the field at all. My daughter stayed for as long as she could, but when Trading Standards then decided they weren't going to proceed to take any action on our behalf, She had to go and stay at her friend's. I mean, we were really, really freezing. We were all huddled up in bed to keep warm and sharing body heat to survive. And, you know, I couldn't home study her. We had no electricity. I couldn't access the internet. When we were freezing, really were. It was awful. What lessons have I learnt from my experience? Wow. That doing good doesn't pay. We'd been far better off sitting back and doing nothing to help nobody. Claiming benefits would have been a far better option than trying to work through that. Far, far worse off self-employed. We knew we would be, because we always have been. We've been excluded right the way through anyway. There's never been anything for irregular earnings, and there's certainly nothing now for the victims of crime. There's no support if you've got a zero wage. What's the future for me and my children? Well, I've got to try and put the whole case through and try to get the refund and compensation for the damages. I'm trying to apply to charities for some form of help. It's 4.5 years now since I've been able to earn my income as anticipated from all of the money going out. I still want to travel. I'm trying to get my daughter into her own home now, because if I can, then I'm no longer responsible. At the moment, I'm still being threatened with, you know, possible eviction or possible imprisonment due to the level of poverty that was created by the crimes against us. It doesn't seem that there's any access to justice whatsoever. And I'd like to know who, where is holding the scales of justice. A second wave of financial crash was also taught in the lecture room in 2002. It was anticipated that the governments would use the taxpayers' funds to bail out the bankers, and the bankers would continue on again exactly as they had before. But this time, because of the overdemand levels on planetary resources, you can't balance the books. So they'd start off by giving the money back to the commercial sector again for their big top-end profits, to start to try to pay the debt payments, I guess, but then it would crash over. How do we follow? I've been sharing things via emails. Everything's all written, but it's an awful lot easier to be able to talk, to be questioned. So I've got a WordPress, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. I write as an Earth Mother and an Archangel, and I'm at LinkedIn as Linda Beamish as well. So I am contactable, but it is very difficult to let people know what's going on. You're stuck in a no-win, no-win situation. You're supposed to be transparent as a social enterprise. On the other hand, you're not supposed to say anything before a court case. And realistically, it'd be nice to have a people's court. WordPress address, if you look me up as an Earth Mother, an Archangel and Earth Mother are both one word, and I think I've got Global Art Projects on there as well. So those are three tabs on the WordPress, blogging as much as I can, YouTube as well. That's written as an Earth Mother too. Thanks, Tony. Good to speak. Thank you.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, that's Ian Dumbrell, also Sonia Morn and Susan Lindauer, as well as Andy Richard and Linda Beamish, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also, Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the National Volunteering website, that's do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Bring you to my heart. signal.